sprang up in her hand, lighting her face and setting a sick blaze of dread alight in Will's stomach. He began to run, Jem at his heels. Tatiana was sagging limply in Tessa's arms, her face starkly twisted into a wail.
"Rupert! Rupert!"
Tessa was struggling with the other girl's weight, and Will wanted to pause to help her, but Jem already had. His hand on Tessa's arm, and it was reasonable. It was his place, as her fiancé. Will savagely yanked his attention away, back to his sister, who was moving between the gap and the hedges, her blade held high as she edged around the grisly remains of Rupert Blackthorne. "Cecily!" Will called in exasperation. She began to turn. And the world exploded. A fountain of dirt and mud sprayed up before them, geysering into the sky. Clods of earth and mud clattered down on them like hail. In the center of the geyser, an enormous blind serpent, a pale grayish-white color, the color of dead flesh, Will thought. A stench came off it like the stench of a grave. Tatiana gave a wail and went limp, pulling Tessa to the ground with her. The worm began to fling itself to and fro, trying to pull free of the earth. Its mouth opened. It was less of a mouth and more of an enormous slash bisecting its head, lined with shark-like teeth. A great keening hiss came from its throat.
"Halt!"
Cecily cried. She held her blazing seraph blade out in front of her. She looked absolutely fearless.
"Get back, damn creature!"
The worm lashed down toward her. She stood fast, her blade in hand, as its great jaws descended, and Will leaped at her, knocking her out of the way. They both rolled into a hedge as the worm's head struck the ground where she had been standing, leaving a sizable dent.
"Will!"
Cecily pulled herself away from him, but not quite in time. Her seraph blade slashed across his forearm, leaving a red burn behind. Her eyes were blue fire.
"That was unnecessary! You're not trained!"
Will shouted, half out of his mind with fury and terror.
"You'll get yourself killed! Stay where you are!"
He reached for her blade, but she twisted away from him and onto her feet. A moment later, the worm was surging down again, its mouth open. Will had dropped his own blade, diving for his sister. It was several feet away. He leaped to the side, avoiding the creature's jaws by inches, and then Jem was there, sword cane in hand. He drove the blade up hard into the side of the worm's body. A hellish scream burst from its throat, and it whipped backward, spraying black blood. With a hiss, it disappeared behind a hedgerow. Will spun around. He could barely see Cecily. Jem had thrown himself between her and Benedict, and he was spattered in black blood and mud. Behind Jem, Tessa had dragged Tatiana into her lap. Their skirts belled out together, Tatiana's gaudy pink mixing with the ruined gold of Tessa's wedding dress. Tessa had bent over her as if to protect her from the sight of her father, and much of the demon blood had splashed upon Tessa's hair and clothes. She looked up, her face pale, and her eyes met Will's. For a moment, the garden, the noise, the stench of blood and demon vanished away, and he was alone in a soundless place with only Tessa. He wanted to run to her, wrap her in his arms, protect her. But it was Jem's place to do those things. Not his. Not his. The moment passed, and Tessa was on her feet, pulling Tatiana up by main force, looping the other girl's arm about her own shoulders, even as Tatiana lolled against her, half-conscious.
"You must move her from here. She'll be killed,"
Will said, sweeping his gaze over the garden.
"She has no training."
Tessa's mouth began to set in its familiar stubborn line. "I don't wish to leave you." Cecily looked horrified.
"You don't think. Wouldn't the creature hold off? She's his daughter. If he has any family feeling left." "He consumed his son-in-law, Ceci,"
Will snapped.
"Tessa, go with Tatiana if you want to save her life. And stay with her by the house. It would be a disaster if she came rushing back here."
"Thank you, Will," Jem murmured as Tessa drew the stumbling girl away as quickly as she could. And Will felt the words as three needle pricks inside his heart. Always when Will did something to protect Tessa, Jem thought it was for his sake, not for Will's. Always Will wished Jem could be entirely right. Each needle prick had its own name. Guilt. Shame. Love.
Cecily screamed. A shadow blotted out the sun, and the hedgerow in front of Will burst apart. He found himself staring down the dark red gullet of a massive worm. Ropes of spittle hung between its enormous teeth. Will snatched for the sword at his belt, but the worm was already rearing back, a dagger protruding from the side of its neck. Will recognized it without turning. It was Jem's. He heard his parabatai cry out a warning, and then the worm was hurtling toward Will again, and he slammed his sword upward through the underside of its jaw. Blood spurted through its teeth, spattering Will's gear with a hissing noise. Something struck the back of his knees, and, unprepared, he went over hard, his shoulders slamming into the turf. He choked as the wind was knocked out of him. The worm's thin, annulated tail was wrapped around his knees. He kicked out, seeing stars, Jem's anxious face, blue sky above him.
Funk! An arrow embedded itself in the worm's tail, just below Will's knee. Benedict's grip loosened, and Will rolled away across the dirt and struggled to his knees, just in time to see Gideon and Gabriel Lightwood pounding toward them across the dirt path. Gabriel held a bow. He was notching it again as he ran, and Will realized with a distant surprise that Gabriel Lightwood had just shot his father to save Will's life. The worm caromed backward, and there were hands under Will's arms, hauling him to his feet. Jem. He released Will, who turned to see that his parabatai already had his sword cane out and was glaring ahead. The demon worm appeared to be writhing in agony, undulating as it swept its great, blind head from side to side, uprooting shrubbery with its thrashings. Leaves filled the air, and the small group of shadow hunters choked on dust. Will could hear Cecily coughing, and longed to tell her to run back to the house, but he knew she wouldn't do it. Somehow the worm, by thrashing its jaws, had worked the sword free. The weapon clattered to the ground among the rose bushes, smeared with black ichor. The worm began to slide backward, leaving a trail of slime and blood. Gideon grimaced and dashed forward to seize up the fallen sword with a gloved hand. Suddenly, Benedict reared up like a cobra, his jaws apart and dripping. Gideon raised the sword, looking impossibly small against the creature's vast bulk.
Gideon!
Was Gabriel, white-faced, raising his bow. Will spun aside as an arrow flew past him and buried itself in the worm's body. The worm yelped and spun, humping its body away from them with incredible speed. As it slithered away, a flick of its tail caught the edge of a statue and squeezed it tightly. The statue exploded into dust, showering into the dry, ornamental pool.
By the angel, it just crushed Sophocles,
noted Will, as the worm vanished behind a large structure shaped like a Greek temple. Has no one respect for the classics these days? Gabriel, breathing hard, lowered his bow.
You fool, he said savagely to his brother. What were you thinking, rushing up to him like that?
Gideon whirled round, pointing his bloody sword at Gabriel.
Not him, it. That is not our father any longer, Gabriel. If you cannot countenance that fact...
I shot him with an arrow, Gabriel shouted. What more do you want of me, Gideon?
Gideon shook his head as if disgusted with his brother. Even Will, who did not like Gabriel, felt a twinge of sympathy for him. He had shot the beast.
We must pursue it, said Gideon. It has gone behind the folly.
The what? Said Will.
The folly, Will, said Jem. It's a decorative structure. I assume there is no real interior. Gideon shook his head. It's merely plaster. If we two were to go around one side of it, and you and James the other.
Cecily, what are you doing? Will demanded,
interrupting Gideon. He knew he sounded like a distracted parent, but he didn't care. Cecily had slid her blade into her belt, and it appeared to be trying to climb one of the small yew trees inside the first row of hedges.
Now is not the time for climbing trees!
She looked toward him angrily, her black hair blowing across her face. She opened her mouth to answer, but before she could speak, there was a sound like an earthquake, and the folly burst apart in shards of plaster. The worm hurtled forth, heading straight toward them with the terrifying speed of an out-of-control train. By the time they reached the front courtyard of Lightwood House, Tessa's neck and back were aching. She was tightly laced into her corset beneath the heavy wedding dress, and the weight of the sobbing Tatiana dragged down her left shoulder painfully. She was relieved to see the carriages come into view. Relieved, and also startled. The scene in the courtyard was so peaceful. The carriages, where they had left them, the horses cropping grass, the facade of the house undisturbed. After half-carrying, half-dragging Tatiana to the first carriage, Tessa wrenched the door open and helped her in, wincing when the other girl's sharp nails dug into her shoulders as she heaved herself and her skirts into the space inside.
"Oh, God," Tatiana moaned. "The shame of it, the terrible shame, that the Clave might know of what has befallen my father. For pity's sake, could he not have thought of me, even for a moment?"
Tessa blinked. "That thing," she said. "I do not think it was capable of thinking of anyone, Mrs. Blackthorne." Tatiana looked at her dizzily, and for a moment Tessa was ashamed of the resentment she had felt toward the other girl. She had not liked being sent away from the gardens, where she might perhaps have helped. But Tatiana had just seen her husband torn to pieces before her eyes by her own father. She was deserving of more sympathy than Tessa had been feeling. Tessa made her voice more gentle. "I know you have had a bad shock. If you would lie down..." "You're very tall," Tatiana said. "Do gentlemen complain of it?" Tessa stared. "And you're dressed as a bride," said Tatiana. "Is that not very odd? Would not gear suit the task better? I understand it is unflattering and needs must as the devil drives, but..." There was a sudden loud crash. Tessa detached herself from the carriage and glanced about. The sound had come from inside the house. Henry, Tessa thought. Henry had gone into the house alone. Of course, the creature was out in the gardens, but nevertheless it was Benedict's house. She thought of the ballroom, full of demons, the last time Tessa had been there, and she gathered up her skirts in both hands. "Remain here, Mrs. Blackthorne," she said. "I must discover the cause of that noise." "No," Tatiana sat bolt upright. "Do not leave me." "I am sorry." Tessa backed away, shaking her head. "I must. Please stay inside the carriage." Tatiana cried something after her, but Tessa had already turned to dash up the steps. She pushed her way through the front doors and emerged in a grand entryway, floored with alternating squares of black and white marble, like a checkerboard. A massive chandelier hung from the ceiling, though none of its tapers were lit. The only light in the place came from the daylight flooding in through the high windows. A curving staircase of great grandeur wound its way upward. "Henry!" Tessa cried. "Henry, where are you?" An answering cry and another crash came from the floor above. Tessa dashed up the stairs, stumbling as her foot caught on the hem of her dress and ripped a seam wide open. She switched the skirt out of the way impatiently and continued running, down a long corridor whose walls were painted powder blue and were hung with dozens of gilt-framed etchings, through a pair of doors, and into another room. It was most assuredly a man's room, a library or an office. The curtains a heavy dark fabric, oil paintings of great ships of war hung on the walls. Rich green wallpaper covered the walls, though it appeared to be mottled with odd dark stains. There was a strange smell to the place. A smell like the one down by the banks of the Thames, where odd things rotted in the weak daylight, and laid over that the coppery tang of blood. A bookcase had tipped over, a welter of smashed glass and broken wood, and on the Persian rug beside it was Henry, locked in a wrestling match with a thing with grey skin and an unnerving number of arms. Henry was yelling and kicking out with his long legs, and the thing, a demon no doubt, was tearing at his gear with claws, its wolf-like snout snapping at his face. Tessa looked around wildly, seized up the poker that lay by the dormant fireplace and charged. She tried to keep her training in mind, all those hours of Gideon's careful talk of calibration and speed and grip, but in the end it seemed pure instinct to drive the long steel rod into the creature's torso, where there would have been a ribcage if it had been a real earthly animal. She heard something crunch as the weapon went in. The demon gave a howl like a baying dog and rolled off Henry, and the poker clattered to the floor. Black ichor sprayed, filling the room with the stench of smoke and rot. Tessa stumbled back, her heel catching on the torn edge of her gown. She fell to the ground just as Henry heaved himself over and, with a muttered curse, slashed the demon across the throat with a dagger-like blade that glowed with runes. The demon gave a gurgling cry and folded up like paper. Henry lurched to his feet, his gingery hair matted with blood and ichor. His gear was torn at the shoulder, scarlet fluid leaking from the wound. "Tessa!" he exclaimed, and then he was beside her, helping her to her feet. "By the angel, we're a pair," he said in his rueful Henry way, looking at her worriedly. "You're not hurt, are you?" She glanced down at herself and saw what he meant. Her dress was soaked with a spray of ichor, and there was an ugly cut on her forearm where she had fallen on the broken glass. It didn't hurt much yet, but there was blood. "I am quite all right," she said. "What happened, Henry? What was that thing, and why was it in here?"
"A guardian demon. I was searching Benedict's desk, and I must have moved or touched something that awoke it. Black smoke poured from the drawer, and it became that. It lunged at me."
"And clawed you," Tessa said in concern. "You're bleeding."
"No, I did that myself, fell on my dagger," Henry said sheepishly, drawing a steely from his belt. "Don't tell Charlotte."
Tessa almost smiled. Then, remembering, she dashed across the room and tugged open the curtains across one of the tall windows. She could see out across the gardens, but not, frustratingly, the Italian garden. They were on the wrong side of the house for that. Green box hedges and flat grass, beginning to brown with winter, stretched out before her. "I must go," she said. "Will and Jem and Cecily, they were battling the creature. It has killed Tatiana Blackthorne's husband. I had to convey her back to the carriage as she was near fainting." There was a silence. Then,
"Tessa," Henry said in an odd voice.
And she turned to see him, arrested in the act of applying an Arazzi to his inner arm. He was staring at the wall across from him. The wall Tessa had thought earlier was oddly mottled and splotched with stains. She saw now that they were no accidental mess. Letters a foot tall, each stretched across the wallpaper, written in what looked like dried black blood.
"The infernal devices are without pity. The infernal devices are without regret. The infernal devices are without number. The infernal devices will never stop coming."
And there, beneath the scrawls, a last sentence, barely readable, as if whoever had written it had been losing the use of his hands. She pictured Benedict locked in his room, going slowly mad as he transformed, smearing the words on the wall with his own ichor-ridden blood.
"May God have mercy on our souls."
The worm lunged, and Will dived forward into a roll, narrowly missing its snapping jaws. He came up into a crouch, then to his feet, and raced along the length of the creature until he reached its thrashing tail. He whirled around and saw the demon looming like a cobra over Gideon and Gabriel, though, to his surprise, it seemed to have frozen, hissing but not attacking. Did it recognize its children? Feel anything for them? It was impossible to tell. Cecily was halfway up the yew tree, clinging to a branch. Hoping that she would see sense and stay there, Will spun toward Jem and held up a hand so his parabatai could see him. They had long ago worked out a series of gestures they used to communicate what they needed in the midst of battle, in case they could not hear each other's voices. Jem's eyes lit with understanding, and he tossed his cane toward Will. In a perfect throw, it sailed end over end, till Will caught it in one hand and clicked the handle. The blade shot out, and Will brought it down swift and hard, cleaving straight through the creature's thick skin. The worm jerked back and howled as Will struck again, parting its tail from its body. Benedict thrashed at both ends, and ichor gushed forth in a sticky blast, coating Will. He ducked away with a shout, his skin burning.
"Will!"
Jem darted towards him. Gideon and Gabriel were slashing at the worm's head, doing their best to keep its attention focused on them. As Will wiped burning ichor from his eyes with his free hand, Cecily dropped from the yew tree and landed squarely on the worm's back. Will dropped the sword cane in shock. He had never done that before, never dropped a weapon in the middle of a battle, but there was his little sister clinging with grim determination to the back of a massive demon worm, like a tiny flea clinging to the fur of a dog. As he stared in horror, Cecily yanked a dagger from her belt and drove it viciously into the demon's flesh.
What does she think she's doing? As if a tiny dagger could kill a thing that size.
Will! Will!
Jem was saying in his ear, his voice urgent, and Will realized he had spoken aloud, and, name of the angel, the worm's head was swinging around towards Cecily, its mouth open and vast and lined with teeth. Cecily let go of the dagger's handle and rolled sideways, off the body of the worm. Its jaws missed her by a hair's breadth and snapped viciously shut on its own body. Black ichor gushed, and the worm jerked its head back, a howl like the wail of a banshee erupting from its throat. A massive wound gaped in its side, and gobbets of its own flesh hung from its jaws. As Will stared, Gabriel raised his bow and let an arrow fly. It sang home to its target and buried itself in one of the worm's lidless black eyes. The creature reared back, and then its head sagged forward and it crumpled in on itself, folding up, disappearing as demons did when the life left them. Gabriel's bow fell to the ground with a clatter that Will barely heard. The trampled ground was soaked with blood from the worm's savaged body. In the midst of it all, Ceci was rising slowly to her feet, wincing, her right wrist twisted at an odd angle. Will did not even feel himself begin to run toward her. He realized it only when he was brought up short by Jem's restraining hand. He turned on his parabatai wildly.
My sister!
Your face, replied Jem, with remarkable calm considering the situation. You're covered in demon blood, William, and it's burning you. I must give you an Uratzi before the damage cannot be undone.
Let me go,
Will insisted, and tried to pull away. But Jem's cool hand was cupping the back of his neck, and then there was a burn of a steely on his wrist, and the pain he had not even known he was feeling began to ebb. Jem let go of him with a small hiss of pain of his own. He had gotten some of the ichor on his fingers. Will paused, irresolute, but Jem waved him away, already applying his own steely to his hand. It was only a moment's delay, but by the time Will reached his sister's side, Gabriel had gotten there first. Gabriel had his hand under her chin, his green eyes flicking over her face. She was looking up at him with astonishment when Will arrived and caught her by the shoulder.
Get away from my sister, he barked,
and Gabriel stepped back, his mouth thinning into a hard line. Gideon was hard on his heels, and they swarmed around Cecily as Will held her fast with one hand, drawing his steely with the other. She looked at him with flashing blue eyes as he carved a black Uratzi against one side of her throat and a Mendelin on the other. Her black hair had escaped from its braid, and she looked like the wild girl he remembered, fierce and unafraid of anything.
Are you hurt, Cariad?
The word slipped out before he could stop it, a childhood endearment he'd almost forgotten.
Cariad, she echoed,
her eyes flashing disbelief.
I'm quite unhurt.
Not quite, Will said, indicating her injured wrist and gashes on her face and hands, which had begun to close up as the Uratzi did its work. Anger swelled up inside him so much that he did not hear Jem, behind him, begin to cough. Usually a sound that would have lit him into action, like a spark thrown into dry tinder.
Cecily, what could you possibly have been?
That was one of the bravest things I've seen a shadow hunter do, interrupted Gabriel.
He was not looking at Will, but at Cecily, with a mixture of surprise and something else in his expression. There was mud and blood in his hair, as there was on all of them, but his green eyes were very bright. Cecily flushed.
I was only...
She broke off, her eyes widening as she looked past Will. Jem coughed again, and this time Will heard it. He turned just in time to see his parabatai slumped to his knees on the ground. Chapter 3 To the Last Hour. Not, I'll not, carry in comfort.
despair not feast on thee, not untwist. Slack they may be, these last strands of man in me, or, most weary, cry I can no more. I can something, hope, wish they come, not choose not to be. Gerard Manley Hopkins, Carrying Comfort. Jem was leaning against the side of the Institute's carriage, his eyes closed, his face as pale as paper. Will stood beside him, his hand tightly gripping Jem's shoulder. Tessa knew as she hurried toward them that it was not just a brotherly gesture. His grip would be much of what was keeping Jem upright. She and Henry had heard the dying scream of the worm. Gabriel had found them, what felt like moments later, racing down the front steps. He had told them breathlessly of the death of the creature, and then of what had happened to Jem, and everything for Tessa had gone white, as if she had been struck suddenly and hard across the face. There were words she had not heard in a long time, but half expected always, and dreamed of sometimes in nightmares that left her bolting upright, fighting for air. Jem. Collapse. Breathing. Blood. Will. Will is with him. Will. Of course Will was with him. The others were swarming about, the Lightwood brothers with their sister, and even Tatiana was quiet. Or perhaps Tessa could simply not hear her hysterics. Tessa was aware of Cecily nearby as well, and Henry standing awkwardly beside her, as if he wished to comfort her but did not know how to begin. Will's eyes met Tessa's as she came closer, almost tripping again over her torn gown. For a moment, they were in perfect understanding. Jem was what they could still look each other straight in the eye about. On the topic of Jem, they were both fierce and unyielding. Tessa saw Will's hand tighten on Jem's sleeve. "She's here," he said. Jem's eyes opened slowly. Tessa fought to keep the look of shock from her face. His pupils were blown out, his irises a thin ring of silver around the black. "Ni shou shang lama, sin aida," he whispered. Jem had been teaching Tessa Mandarin at her insistence. She understood sin aida, at least, if not the rest. "My dear, my darling." She reached for his hand, squeezed it. "Jem? Are you hurt, my love?" Will said. His voice was as level as his eyes, and for a moment the blood came up in Tessa's cheeks, and she glanced down at her hand where it held Jem's. His fingers were paler than hers, like a doll's hands made of porcelain. How had she not seen he was so ill? "Thank you for the translation, Will," she answered, not looking away from her fiancé. Jem and Will were both splattered with black ichor, but Jem's chin and throat were also stained with flecks of red blood, his own blood. "I am not hurt," Tessa whispered. And then she thought, "No, this will not do, not at all. Be strong for him." She straightened her shoulders, keeping a grip on Jem's hand. "Where is his medicine?" she demanded of Will. "Did he not take it before we left the Institute?" "Do not talk about me as if I'm not here," Jem said. But there was no anger in it. He turned his head to the side and said something softly under his breath to Will, who nodded and let go of his shoulder. Tessa could sense the tension in Will's posture. He was poised, cat-like, to seize Jem again if the other boy should slip or fall, but Jem remained standing. "I'm stronger when Tessa is here, you see. I told it to you," said Jem, still in the same soft voice. At that, Will did duck his head so that Tessa could not see his eyes. "I see it," he said. "Tessa, there is none of his medicine here. I believe he left the Institute without taking enough of it, though he will not admit it. Ride back to the Institute with him in the carriage, and watch over him. Someone must." Jem took a breath. "The others. I will drive for you. It'll be little trouble. Balios and Xanthos know the way. Henry can drive the Lightwoods." Will was brisk and efficient, too brisk and efficient to even be thanked. He did not seem as if he wanted it. He helped Tessa get Jem into the carriage, very careful not to brush her shoulder or touch her hand as he did. He moved to tell the others what was happening. She caught a bit of Henry explaining that he needed to remove Benedict's record books from the house before she reached to swing the carriage door closed, shutting herself and Jem into a welcome silence. What was inside the house? Jem asked as they rattled through the open gate bordering the Lightwoods' property. He still looked ghastly, his head back against the cushions of the carriage, his eyes at half-mast, his cheekbones shining with fever. I heard Henry speaking of Benedict's study. He had gone mad in there, she said, chafing his cold hands between hers. In the days before he transformed, when Gabriel said he would not leave the room, his mind must have gone. He had scrawled on the wall in what looked like blood sentences about the infernal devices, that they had no pity, that they would never stop coming. He must have meant the automaton army. He must have. Tessa shivered slightly and moved closer to Jem. I suppose it was foolish of me, but it has been so peaceful for these past 2 months that...
You had forgotten about Mortmain?
No, never forgotten. She glanced toward the window, though she could not see out. She had drawn the curtains when the light had seemed to be hurting Jem's eyes. Hoped, perhaps, that he might have turned his mind elsewhere.
We do not know that he hasn't.
Jem's fingers wrapped around hers. Benedict's death is a tragedy, perhaps, but those wheels were set in motion long ago. This has nothing to do with you. There were other items in the library. Notes and books of Benedict's. Journals. Henry is bringing them back to the Institute to study. My name was in them. Tessa stopped herself. How could she trouble Jem with these things when he was so unwell? As if Jem were reading her mind, his finger moved over her wrist, resting slightly on her pulse point.
Tessa, it's only a passing attack. It will not last. I would rather you told me the truth, all the truth, whether it is bitter or frightening, that I may share it with you. I would never let harm come to you, nor would any in the Institute.
He smiled.
Your pulse is quickening. The truth, all the truth, whether it is bitter or frightening. I love you, she said.
He looked at her with a light in his thin face that made it more beautiful.
Wai si wong ni min tin kai jai de wa.
You, she drew her brows together. You want to get married? But we're already engaged. I do not think one can get engaged twice. He laughed, which turned into a cough. Tessa's whole body tightened, but the cough was slight and there was no blood.
I said I would marry you tomorrow, if I could.
Tessa pretended to toss her head. Tomorrow is not convenient for me, sir. But you are already appropriately attired, he said with a smile. Tessa looked down at the ruined gold of her wedding dress. If I were getting married in the slaughterhouse, she allowed. Ah, well. I did not like this one very much as it was. Much too gaudy.
I thought you looked beautiful.
His voice was soft. Tessa laid her head against his shoulder. There will be another time, she said. Another day, another dress. A time when we are all well and everything is perfect. His voice was still gentle, but it held a terrible weariness.
There is no such thing as perfect, Tessa.
Sophie was standing at the window of her small bedroom, the curtain drawn back, her eyes fixed on the courtyard. It had been hours since the carriages had gone rattling away, and she was meant to be sweeping out the grates, but the brush and bucket were motionless at her feet. She could hear Bridget's voice drifting softly up from the kitchen below.
Earl Richard had a daughter. A comely maid was she, and she laid her love on sweet William, though not of his degree.
Sometimes, when Bridget was in a particularly melodious mood, Sophie thought about stalking downstairs and pushing her into the oven like the witch in Hansel and Gretel. But Charlotte would certainly not approve. Even if Bridget were singing about forbidden love between the social classes, just at the same moment that Sophie was cursing herself for clutching the curtain fabric tightly in her hand, seeing grey-green eyes in her mind as she wondered and worried, would Gideon be all right? Was he hurt? Could he fight his father? And how dreadful if he had to. The gates of the Institute creaked open, and a carriage rattled inside. Will was driving. Sophie recognized him, hatless, his black hair wild in the wind.
He leaped down from the driver's seat and came around to help Tessa out of the carriage. Even at this distance, Sophie could see that a bleak wreck had been made of her golden gown. And then Jem, leaning heavily on his Parabatai's shoulder. Sophie sucked in her breath. Though she no longer fancied herself in love with Jem, she still cared for him a great deal. It was not hard to, considering his open-heartedness, his sweetness and graciousness. He had never been anything but exquisitely kind to her. She had been relieved over the past months that he had not had one of his bad spells, as Charlotte called them. That though happiness had not healed him, he had seemed to be stronger, better. The threesome had disappeared inside the Institute. Cyril had come from the stables and was dealing with the wickering Balios and Xanthos. Sophie took a deep breath and let the curtain fall away from her hand. Charlotte might need her, want her to assist with Jem. If there was anything she could do. She pulled herself from the window and hurried into the corridor and down the narrow servant stairs. In the hall downstairs she met Tessa, ashen and pinch-looking, hesitating just outside Jem's bedroom. Through the partly open door, Sophie could see Charlotte bending over Jem, who was sitting on the bed. Will leaned by the fireplace, his arms crossed, tension clear in every line of his body. Tessa raised her head as she saw Sophie, a little of the colour coming back into her face.
"Sophie," she cried softly. "Sophie, Jem isn't well. He's had another bout of illness. He'll be all right, Miss Tessa. I've seen him very ill before, and he always comes through it, right as rain."
Tessa closed her eyes. The shadows beneath them were grey. She did not need to say what they were both thinking, that one day there would be a time when he would have an attack, and he would not come through it.
"I ought to be fetching hot water," Sophie added, "and cloths." "I should be fetching those things," said Tessa. "And I would, but Charlotte says that I must change out of this dress. The demon blood can be dangerous if too greatly encounters the skin. She sent Bridget for cloths and poultices, and Brother Enoch will arrive at any moment, and Jem will not hear otherwise, but..."
"That is enough," Sophie said firmly. "You will do him no good at all if you let yourself become ill as well. I will help you with the dress. Come, let us manage it, and quickly."
Tessa's eyes fluttered open.
"Dear sensible Sophie, of course you are right."
She began to move across the corridor toward her room. At the door she paused and turned to look at Sophie. Her wide grey eyes searched the other girl's face, and she seemed to nod to herself as if she'd been proved right in a guess.
"He is all right, you know. Not hurt at all. Master Jem?"
Tessa shook her head.
"Gideon Lightwood."
Sophie blushed.
Gabriel wasn't quite sure why he was in the Institute's drawing room, except that his brother had told him to come here and wait. And even after everything that had happened, he was still used to doing what Gideon said. He was surprised at how plain the room was. Nothing like the grand drawing rooms in either the Lightwoods' Pimlico house or the one in Chiswick. The walls were papered with a faded print of cabbaged roses, the surface of the desk stained with ink and scarred with the marks of letter openers and pen nibs, and the grate was sooty. Over the fireplace hung a water-blotched mirror, framed in gilt. Gabriel glanced at his own reflection. His gear was torn at the neck, and there was a red mark on his jaw where a long graze was in the process of healing. There was blood all over his gear.
"Your own blood, or your father's blood?"
He pushed the thought away quickly. It was odd, he thought, how he was the one who looked like their mother, Barbara. She had been tall and inclined towards slenderness. With curling brown hair and eyes, he remembered as the purest green, like the grass that sloped down toward the river behind the house. Gideon looked like their father, broad and stocky, with eyes more grey than green. Which was ironic, because Gabriel was the one who had inherited their father's temperament, headstrong and quick to anger, slow to forgive. Gideon and Barbara were more peacemakers, quiet and steady, faithful in their beliefs. They were both much more like... Charlotte Brownwell came in through the open door of the drawing room in a loose dress, her eyes as bright as a small bird's. Whenever Gabriel saw her, he was struck by how small she was, how he towered over her.
What had Consul Whalen been thinking, giving this tiny creature power over the Institute and all the shadow hunters of London? Gabriel. She inclined her head. Your brother says you are not hurt.
I'm quite all right,
he said shortly, and immediately knew he had sounded rude. He had not meant to, precisely. His father had drilled into his head for years now what a fool Charlotte was, how useless and easily influenced. And though he knew his brother disagreed enough to come live in this place and leave his family behind, it was a hard lesson to put aside. I thought you would be with Carstairs.
Brother Enoch has arrived, with another of the Silent Brothers. They have banned us all from Jem's room. Will is pacing outside the corridor like a caged panther. Poor boy.
Charlotte looked at Gabriel briefly before walking to the fireplace. In her glance was a look of keen intelligence, quickly masked by the lowering of her eyelashes.
But enough of that. I understand that your sister has already been delivered to the Blackthorns' residence in Kensington, she said. Is there someone you would like me to send a message to for you?
Message?
She paused before the fireplace, clasping her hands behind her back.
You need to go somewhere, Gabriel. Unless you want me to turn you out of doors with only the key of the streets to your name.
Turn me out of doors? Was this horrible woman actually throwing him out of the Institute?
He thought of what his father had always told him.
The Fairchilds don't care about anyone but themselves and the law.
The house in Pimlico...
The Consul will shortly be informed of all that transpired at the Lightwood House, said Charlotte. Both of your family's London residences will be confiscated in the name of the Clave, at least until they can be searched and it can be determined that your father left nothing behind that could provide the Council with clues.
Clues to what?
To your father's plans, she said unfazed. To his connection to Mortmain, his knowledge of Mortmain's plans, to the infernal devices.
I've never heard of the bloody infernal devices,
Gabriel protested and then blushed. He had sworn, and in front of a lady. Not that Charlotte was quite like any other lady.
I believe you, she said. I don't know if Consul Whalen will, but that is your lookout. If you will give me an address...
I haven't got one, Gabriel said in desperation. Where do you think I could go?
She just looked at him, one eyebrow raised.
I want to stay with my brother,
he said finally, aware that he sounded petulant and angry, but not quite sure what to do about it.
But your brother lives here, she said, and you have made your feelings about the Institute and about my claim to it very clear. Jem told me what you believe, that my father drove your uncle to suicide. It isn't true, you know, but I don't expect you to believe me. It does leave me wondering, however, why you would wish to remain here.
The Institute is a refuge.
Was your father planning on running it as a refuge?
I don't know. I don't know what his plans are, what they were.
Then why did you go along with them? Her voice was soft but merciless.
Because he was my father,
Gabriel shouted. He spun away from Charlotte, his breath becoming ragged in his throat. Only barely aware of what he was doing, he wrapped his arms around himself, hugging his own body tight, as if he could keep himself from coming undone. Memories of the past few weeks, memories that Gabriel had been doing his best to press back into the very recesses of his mind, threatened to burst out into the light. Weeks in the house after the servants had been sent away, hearing the noises coming from the upstairs rooms, screams in the night, blood on the stairs in the morning. Father shouting gibberish from behind the locked library door, as if he could no longer form words in English.
If you are going to throw me out on the street,
Gabriel said, with a sort of terrible desperation, then do it now.
I do not want to think I have got a home when I have not. I do not want to think I am going to see my brother again if I am not going to.
You think he would not go after you? Find you wherever you were? I think he has proved who he cares for most, said Gabriel. And it is not me.
He slowly straightened, loosing his grip on himself.
Send me away or let me stay. I will not beg you.
Charlotte sighed.
You will not have to, she said.
Never before have I sent away anyone who told me that they had nowhere else to go, and I will not start now. I will ask of you only one thing. To allow someone to live in the Institute, in the very heart of the Enclave, is to place my trust in their good intentions.
Do not make me regret that I have trusted you, Gabriel Lightwood.
The shadows had lengthened in the library. Tessa sat in a pool of light by one of the windows beside a shaded blue lamp. A book had been open on her lap for several hours, but she had not been able to concentrate on it. Her eyes skidded over the words on the pages without absorbing them, and she would often find that she was pausing to try to remember who her character was, or why they were doing what they were doing. She was in the middle of beginning chapter 5 yet again, when the creak of a floorboard alerted her, and she looked up to find Will standing before her, damp-haired, his gloves in his hands.
Will, Tessa set the book down on the windowsill beside her. You startled me.
I didn't mean to interrupt, he said in a low voice. If you were reading. He began to turn away.
I am not,
she said, and he stopped, looking back at her over his shoulder. I cannot lose myself in words now. I cannot calm the distraction of my mind.
Nor I, he said, turning fully now.
He was no longer spattered in blood. His clothes were clean, and his skin mostly unmarked, though she could see the pinkish-white lines of grazes on his neck, disappearing down into the collar of his shirt, healing as the Eratzis did their work.
Is there any news of my... Is there news of Jem?
There is no change, he said.
Though she had guessed as much, if there had been a change, Will would not have been here. The brothers would still not let anyone into the room, not even Charlotte.
And why are you here? He went on, sitting in the dark.
Benedict wrote on the wall of his study, she said in a low voice. Before he turned into that creature, I imagine, or while it was happening, I don't know. The infernal devices are without pity. The infernal devices are without regret. The infernal devices are without number. The infernal devices will never stop coming.
The infernal devices. I assume he means Mortmain's clockwork creatures. Not that we've seen any of them for months.
That does not mean that they will not come back, Tessa said.
She looked down at the library table, its scratch veneer. How often Will and Jem must have sat here together, studying, carving their initials as bored schoolboys did into the table's surface.
I am a danger to you here.
Tessa, we've talked about this before. You're not the danger. You are the thing that Mortmain wants, yes. But if you were not here and protected, he could get you easily. And to what destruction would he turn your powers? We don't know. Own that he wants you for something, and it is to our advantage to keep you from him. 'Tis not selflessness. We shadow hunters are not selfless.
She looked up at that. I think you're very selfless. At his noise of disagreement, she said, surely you must know what you do is exemplary. There is a coldness to the clave, it is true. We are dust and shadows. But you are like the heroes of ancient times, like Achilles and Jason.
Achilles was murdered with a poison arrow, and Jason died alone, killed by his own rotting ship. Such is the fate of heroes. The angel knows why anyone would want to be one.
Tessa looked at him. There were shadows under his blue eyes, she saw, and his fingers were worrying at the material of his cuffs thoughtlessly, as if he were not aware he was doing it. Months, she thought, months since they had been alone together for more than a moment. They'd had only accidental encounters in hallways, in the courtyard, awkwardly exchanged pleasantries. She had missed his jokes, the books he had lent her, the flashes of laughter in his gaze. Caught in the memory of the easier Will of an earlier time, she spoke without thinking.
I cannot stop recollecting something you told me once, she said.
He looked at her in surprise.
Yes. And what is that?
That sometimes when you cannot decide what to do, you pretend you are a character in a book, because it is easier to decide what they would do.
I am, Will said.
Perhaps not someone to take advice from if you are seeking happiness. Not happiness, not exactly. I want to help, to do good. She broke off and sighed. And I have turned to many books, but if there is guidance in them, I have not found it. You said you were Sidney Carton.
Will made a sound and sank down onto a chair on the opposite side of the table from her. His lashes were lowered, veiling his eyes.
And I suppose I know what that makes the rest of us, she said. But I do not want to be Lucy Manette. For she did nothing to save Charles. She let Sidney do it all. And she was cruel to him.
To Charles, Will said.
To Sidney, Tessa said. He wanted to be a better man. But she would not help him.
She could not. She was engaged to Charles Darnay.
Still, it was not kind, Tessa said.
Will threw himself out of his chair as quickly as he had thrown himself into it. He leaned forward, his hands on the table. His eyes were very blue in the blue light of the lamp.
Sometimes one must choose whether to be kind or honorable, he said. Sometimes one cannot be both.
Which is better? Tessa whispered.
Will's mouth twisted with bitter humor.
I suppose it depends on the book.
Tessa craned her head back to look at him.
You know that feeling, she said, when you are reading a book, and you know that it is going to be a tragedy. You can feel the cold and darkness coming. You see the net drawing close around the characters who live and breathe on the pages. But you are tied to the story as if being dragged behind a carriage, and you cannot let go or turn the course aside.
His blue eyes were dark with understanding. Of course Will would understand. And she hurried on.
I feel now as if the same's happening, only not to characters on a page, but to my own beloved friends and companions. I do not want to sit by while tragedy comes for us. I would turn it aside, only I struggle to discover how that might be done.
You fear for Jem, Wolf said.
Yes, she said. And I fear for you, too.
No, Will said hoarsely. Don't waste that on me, Tess.
Before she could reply, the library door opened. It was Charlotte, looking drained and exhausted. Will turned toward her quickly.
How is Jem? He said.
He is awake and talking, said Charlotte.
He has had some of the Yin Fen, and the Silent Brothers have been able to make his condition stable and to stop the internal bleeding.
At the mention of internal bleeding, Will looked as if he were going to throw up. Tessa imagined she looked much the same.
He can have a visitor, Charlotte went on. In fact, he has requested it.
Will and Tessa exchanged a quick glance. Tessa knew what both were thinking. Which of them should the visitor be? Tessa was Jem's fiancé, but Will was his parabatai, which was sacred in and of itself. Will had begun to step back, when Charlotte spoke again, sounding tired down to her bones.
He asked for you, Will.
Will looked startled. He darted a glance at Tessa. Tessa could not deny the little burst of surprise and almost jealousy that she had felt behind her ribcage at Charlotte's words, but she pushed it down ruthlessly. She loved Gemma enough to want whatever he wanted for himself, and he always had his reasons.
You go, she said gently. Of course he would want to see you.
Will began to move toward the door to join Charlotte. Halfway there he turned back and crossed the room to Tessa.
Tessa, he said, while I am with Jem, would you do something for me?
Tessa looked up and swallowed. He was too close, too close. All the lines, shapes, angles of Will filled her field of vision as the sound of his voice filled her ears.
Yes, certainly, she said. What is it? To Edmund and Lynette Herondale, Ravenscar Manor, West Riding, Yorkshire. Dear Dad and Mam, I know it was cowardly of me to have left as I did in the early morning before you woke, with only a note to explain my absence. I could not bear to face you, knowing what I had decided to do, and that I was the worst of disobedient daughters.
How can I explain the decision I made? How I arrived at it? It seems, even now, like madness. Each day, in fact, is madder than the one before it. You did not lie, Dad, when you said the life of a shadow hunter was like a feverish dream.
Cecily drew the nib of the pen viciously through the lines she had written, then crumpled up the paper in one hand and rested her head on the desk. She had started this letter so many times, and had yet to arrive at any satisfactory version. Perhaps she should not be attempting it now, she thought, not when she had been trying to calm her nerves since they had returned to the Institute. Everyone had been swarming about Jem, and Will, after roughly checking her for injuries in the garden, had barely spoken to her again. Henry had gone running for Charlotte, Gideon had drawn Gabriel aside, and Cecily had found herself climbing the Institute stairs alone. She had slipped into her bedroom, not bothering to divest herself of her gear, and curled up on the soft four-poster bed. As she'd lain among the shadows, hearing the faint sounds of London passing by outside, her heart had clenched with sudden, painful homesickness. She thought of the green hills of Wales, and of her mother and father, and had bolted out of bed, as if she had been pushed, stumbling to the desk and taking up pen and paper, the ink staining her fingers in her haste. And yet the right words would not come. She felt as if she bled her regret, her loneliness from her very pores, and yet she could not shape those feelings into any sentiment that she could imagine her parents could bear reading. At that moment there was a knock on the door. Cecily reached for a book she had left resting on the desk, propped it up as if she had been reading, and called, "Come in." The door swung open. It was Tessa, standing hesitantly in the doorway. She was no longer wearing her destroyed wedding dress, but a simple gown of blue muslin with her two necklaces glittering at her throat. The clockwork angel and the jade pendant that had been her bridal gift from Jem. Cecily looked at Tessa curiously. Though the two girls were friendly, they were not close. Tessa had a certain wariness around her that Cecily suspected the source of without ever being able to prove it. On top of that, there was something fey and strange about her. Cecily knew she could shapeshift, could transform herself into the likeness of any person, and Cecily could not rid herself of the sense that it was unnatural. How could you know someone's true face if they could change it as easily as someone else might change a gown? "Yes," Cecily said. "Miss Gray." "Please call me Tessa," said the other girl, shutting the door behind her. It was not the first time she had asked Cecily to call her by her given name, but habit and perversity kept Cecily from doing it. "I came to see if you were all right, and if you needed anything." "Ah." Cecily felt a slight pang of disappointment. "I'm quite all right." Tessa moved forward slightly. "Is that Great Expectations?" "Yes." Cecily did not say that she had seen Will reading it, and had picked it up to try to gain insight into what he was thinking. So far she was woefully lost. Pip was morbid, and Estella so awful that Cecily wanted to shake her. "Estella," Tessa said softly, "till the last hour of my life, you cannot choose but remain part of my character, part of the little good in me, part of the evil." "So you memorize passages of the books, just like Will? Or is this a favorite?" "I don't have Will's memory," said Tessa, coming forward slightly, "or his Nemesine rune. But I do love that book." Her gray eyes searched Cecily's face. "Why are you still in your gear?" "I was thinking of going up to the training room," Cecily said. "I find I can think well there, and it isn't as if anyone minds one way or the other what I do." "More training? Cecily, you've just been in battle," Tessa protested. "I know it can sometimes take more than one application of runes to entirely heal. Before you start training again, I should call someone to you, Charlotte or..."
"Or Will," Cecily snapped. "If either of them cared, they would have come already."
Tessa paused by the bedside.
"You cannot think Will doesn't care about you."
"He isn't here, is he?"
"He sent me," Tessa said, "because he is with Jem."
As if that explained everything. Cecily supposed that in a way it did. She knew that Will and Jem were close friends.
but also that it was more than that. She had read of Parabatai in the Codex, and knew that the bond was one that did not exist among